Hi, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host. In this installation of our program, we will be speaking with Lewis Aaron and Karen Starr regarding their publication, Psychotherapy for the People, Toward a Progressive Psychoanalysis, Routledge 2013. And this interview takes place before a live audience, which is a new road taken for New Books in Psychoanalysis. We spoke with them at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies in New York City, and before a crowd of perhaps 100 and change of analysts from many stripes who were happy to hear the interview and also get in on the act. So I have a plethora of co-hosts. I did have them name themselves, so you'll know who's who and who's saying what. We also want to encourage people with this interview in particular, because the book is sort of pivotal and offering a new paradigm of the how psychoanalysis in America took such a conservative turn. We would love to have people write in on the webcast and their experience of it. And the authors, Aaron and Starr, are also going to be checking in and responding to posts. So if you've ever wanted to speak with either of them, this is your opportunity. Upcoming will be Robert Stallaro in January with his book, World Affectivity and Trauma. And I will have a co-host on that interview. It'll be Josie Oppenheim. Will be joining me to interview Dr. Stallaro. So without further ado, as the authors are introduced in full during the live interview itself, let's sally forth and see what you think about New Books in Psychoanalysis in front of a crowd.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for coming out. I'm Jacqueline Ambrosini, and I'm with the Student Association of CMPS and NYGSP. We are delighted to have you all tonight. So we've been honoring students and candidates who have gotten nominated for the Gradivo Awards or have won the Gradivo Award. And so tonight we are delighted to be honoring Tracy Morgan for her new media podcast, New Books in Psychoanalysis. And so she's been doing a live interview tonight. Before I do more of an introduction, I do want to do a plug for our conference that's coming up on December 7th. So this year's conference is going to be the Repetition Compulsion Revisited. And so it's going to be repetitive. It's going to be repetitive from a neuroscience perspective, from a free association perspective, from a Lacanian and a modern analysis perspective, and how resistance works in repetition in clinical practice. And it's going to be a very exciting, fun conference with a lot of great thinkers, and we usually have a lot of fun. It's an all-day affair at NYU, and so there's brochures out on the table, so please take one, sign up, come if you're a candidate or student, you get discounted. So please come. So it really gives me deep pleasure to introduce Tracy Morgan. If any of you have come across Tracy, or listen to her podcast, you know she's a force to be reckoned with. And she is a lovely, warm person with keen intelligence, wit, generosity, and I've been very fortunate to have consulted with her many times, and I have certainly benefited from her insight and from her curiosity, her passion, her humor, and it's made me a much better clinician. And so, in addition, Tracy just this week graduated from CMPS.
Thank you.
in the history of medicine and sexuality, and she holds a master's in philosophy from CUNY Graduate Center, as well as a master's in social work from Hunter School of Social Work. So I'll pass it over to you.
Is Emma Sini? Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. So this is a strange arrangement because usually I do this at home in my pajamas. That's usually 4 in the afternoon on a Friday, and I definitely don't have people to look at when I interview them. So before I go any further, I wanted to thank the Student Association of CMPS for this invitation. It's really terrific. Over the past year, Jackie Ambrosini, Madeline Escobar, Alexa Rosian, Elia Zedeno, and more recently Alyssa Krieger have given students from CMPS a great opportunity to present their work. And I understand that these were really wonderfully attended events. Unfortunately, I was unable to attend. I was working on my final paper, which I just finished. So I was really delighted to be asked. I want to say a few words about what's going to happen this evening so we all get the lay of the land. First of all, you are now being recorded. Anything you say, okay, anything you say will make it on to the New Books in Psychoanalysis webcast. So we were going to encourage everyone to speak if you want to, but if you don't want to speak, make sure to not speak, because whatever you say will be available in perpetuity on the New Books in Psychoanalysis webcast if you don't edit. Please turn off your cell phones unless you feel you must be available to your patients, very modern, picking up, doing a low, little session, or your children, or whomever. Eventually, everyone will be invited to speak, and you can consider yourself a co-host at that point. If you have a question to ask to the authors. And when you speak, I ask that we're going to hand out mics at that point. This will be about 50 minutes in from now. And then you say your name, and then ask your question. Because, you know, why shouldn't you have your name out there? Unless you really don't want to, and then, you know, you're free to not say your name. So I'm going to do a traditional New Books in Psychoanalysis interview, but in a skirt, not in my pajamas. And we'll go perhaps until 9 p.m., 9:15. When we're ready to stop, I'm going to need to ask for a little bit of cooperation, which is that I'm also speaking to an audience, not right now, but think about it, like when you listen to New Books in Psychoanalysis, if you do at the end, you say, thanks to the authors, we look forward to you getting back to us when we write another book, hopefully not as long as this one. And because that's all it was a lot to read. And then we'll say something about who the next interviewee will be, and then I'll just say, you know, this is your devoted host, Tracy Morgan, signing off till next time. At that point, we're done. Mr. Cahill will do whatever he does with the recording, and we can all get up and go to the next room and, you know, have wine and cheese and relax. I'm supposed to put in a word from our sponsors. The Student Association, and I would like to thank Joseph Avalone, owner of Summit Investigative Service in Forest Hills, for providing us with food. Blake Birmingham, Director of Operations at Mixed Beverage LLC, provided the wine. I also heard there may be something like a skinny margarita, or some such created by buyer for Nicki Minaj. And the mention of Nicki Minaj on this webcast will diversify the listening audience in ways you can't even imagine. they'll do this? Who knows? Okay, so now I'd like to interview, Drs. Lewis Aaron and Dr. Karen Starr. They are the authors of, you guys hold up, mine is ripped to shreds because it's heavy and I can tear out chapters, I've been reading it for 3 months. So this is their new book, A Psychotherapy for the People, Toward Progressive Psychoanalysis, published by Routledge, 2013. Dr. Aaron, as many of you may know, he runs the postdoc, the NYU postdoc, an analytic institute housed in the university, Freud would be very pleased, where I believe primarily psychologists study the impossible profession. Yes? And Dr. Aaron once ran Division 39 at the APA, yeah? And He has co-authored countless articles and books, among them A Meeting of Minds. Dr. Starr is a winner of the Ruth Stein Prize, and she's a candidate, still a candidate? Okay, a candidate of the postdoc, and author of what sounds like a fascinating book, Repair of the Soul, Metaphors of Transformation in Judaism and Psychoanalysis. Both maintain private practices in New York City. I just have a quick thought before we get things underway. I usually don't see people's facial expressions when I interview them. It is, as I said, me, the pajamas, my dining room table, a lot of this stuff here, and I don't usually make eye contact, and I was thinking about how interesting it is that the first time I'm doing a live interview where eye contact is involved, I have two relational analysts here, and I'm used to a sort of one-person model where if you lay on the couch and we don't make eye contact, and if there was just one of you, I was going to bring up the couch. I do couples treatment, I don't do that. I'm not used to eye contact in this, so we'll see how it goes. And I wonder if a good interview is just a deeply unsocial thing, after all said and done. So, and I have about 50 questions. So why don't we get ourselves started? The first question that I ask everyone that I've ever interviewed is what prompted the writing of this book?
After you,
I'll start.
You can continue. These are ideas that Lou has spent a lot of time thinking about for many years, and he and I share an interest in the intersection of Judaism and psychoanalysis. Lou was one of my committee members when I was working on my dissertation, which is ended up becoming Repair of the Soul, and he invited me one day to write this book with him and to really just help articulate ideas that he's been thinking about for a long time, but also that drew upon both of our interests in the Jewish roots and the Jewish influences of psychoanalysis and how that reverberates even unto today in this series.
Let me add a little bit to that. First of all, thank you for inviting us to do this, and thanks for having us here.
Thanks for accepting.
I think that over the last many years, I've been very focused on psychoanalytic education. And as I think everyone here is very well aware, psychoanalysis has just changed enormously in terms of its status in our culture and what that means in terms of who's becoming a psychoanalyst, how one becomes a psychoanalyst, the nature of psychoanalytic institutes, organizations. And I got very interested in the history of that in terms of how the history of our culture and the history of the shifts has affected the profession and the education of the profession. As part of that, the history that Karen is mentioning is the history of trauma, immigration, Jewish culture, and the way in which that affected us.
Okay, so now I have to look at you and think and do this at the same time. How strange it is. okay. First question I had that I wanted to ask, wanted to pose was, in this book, there seems to be an argument for a blurring of the boundaries between psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, which makes it a very interesting book for modern analysts, I think, in many respects as well. I get the sense that the relational project is at times deemed unpsychoanalytic. For example, Arnold Richard, among others, comes to mind in his ongoing fights with Stephen Mitchell. What role, if any, would you like to have this book play in addressing the demotion of the relational position? Great questions.
Well, let me start with the beginning, and I'll see if I can follow Spotnitz and just keep talking.
Good.
See where I go. I think that the first thing I'd say is, you know, those fights between Arnie and Steve are over.
Right.
Unfortunately, I wish Steve was still around because those were great fights, and it would be interesting to see where they landed. I would actually not go along with the premise of the question, which is that I don't think our effort is to not have a differentiation between psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. I think what we're most interested in is eliminating them as binary oppositions. But it's very different to eliminate them as binary oppositions, one being defined by, as not what the other is. It's very different from saying that there's no difference between them. So, for example, you brought up a couch, and I think that a treatment done on a couch is different from a treatment done face-to-face, is different from a treatment where you walk in the park, is different from where you're on treadmills together. I think that seeing someone four times a week is different from seeing someone once a week. And I wouldn't want to minimize those differences. I think those differences need to be studied, that they're different for different patients, different analysts, different dyads. So I'm not interested in eliminating difference. What we were really interested in when we were writing is the way in which psychoanalysis came to define itself as not psychotherapy. It defined itself by what it wasn't. A definition by opposition. And so everything about psychoanalysis was identified, this is post-World War II, in America largely, with many immigrants fleeing Hitler, at a time that America was very powerful, when psychoanalysis was becoming powerful within psychiatry, which was becoming powerful within medicine, a time that it was 93% and more men who were modeling themselves on surgeons, finding themselves in a powerful, elite medical specialty. And they defined themselves in opposition to psychotherapy, which was nurturing, relationship, support, care. But they didn't want to provide care. They were doctors. They were going to provide treatment. And it was going to be science. It wasn't going to be magic or just a relationship. So it's one thing to deconstruct a binary and say these things are not oppositional, that there's a range. It's another thing to eliminate differences between them, and I wouldn't want to do that. The second part of your question, if I followed it, had to do with the place of relational psychoanalysis. And that's intimately tied to the first, because in the original definition, by original I mean not Freud's, I mean the definition of the early 1950s, by definition, psychoanalysis couldn't be relational because relational is what was put into psychotherapy. Psychotherapy was about a supportive relationship for patients who were not analyzable and therefore needed care. The analysts were going to provide the treatment. So by definition, psychoanalysis couldn't be relational in those days. As that dichotomy is deconstructed, there's room for relationality in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis.
That's a big answer. I wanted to, I sent the authors an email probably a couple weeks ago when I was, maybe a month ago, when I was reading the book and I was thinking to myself about halfway through it. I was confronted with this argument about psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, and that there seems to be this split, and this wondering, maybe, I don't know if others wonder who work in this field, but am I doing psychoanalysis yet? Is this psychoanalysis? How do I know when I reach a psychoanalytic moment? I think somebody, I don't know who it was, wrote that if you can do psychoanalysis a few minutes each session, you're doing well. I forget what analysis that was, but that made me feel better. The question is, am I doing analysis yet? Is kind of like a small headache, a small chronic headache. And so I experienced the book as a softening of some kind of sick self-attack or a strong superego, you know, like you're not there yet. You know, I was thinking of being modern, like most of us see patients, you know, I'll see a patient once a month, who can only tolerate that much contact. So it was really validating to read this. And I'm wondering, I mean, I found the argument to be very, very seductive, and I liked it. But was it your intention to loosen things up for clinicians who may be riddled with this kind of shame?
Absolutely. And actually, that was one of the main motivations, you know, one of the ideas that
one of the pressures that sparked this book was, you know, about psychoanalytic education. We're training candidates to see patients 3-4 times a week. We're requiring a personal analysis minimum of 3 times a week. And it's years and years of training, as you know very well. And then when you graduate with a certificate in psychoanalysis and you're a psychoanalyst, how many patients do you end up seeing 3 times a week, lying on the couch or not? Most people end up seeing patients much less frequently than 3 times a week. Even if, you know, there was a survey done by Columbia Psychoanalytic where they require 4 times a week, you know, training cases. And a very tiny percentage of the people post-graduation who were graduated as psychoanalysts actually did what we would call, you know, what could be called psychoanalysis proper, which is 4 times a week on the couch. So in fact, the question is, what are we doing? The question is, you know, what are we training people to do? You know, you're putting so much time and effort in. What is a psychoanalyst? And we're claiming in this book that psychoanalysis is a way of looking at the world. It's a way of listening to patients deeply, thinking dynamically, and whether you're seeing patients 3 times a week or 2 times a week, or like who said on the treadmill, you still could be doing psychoanalysis. We also look at broadening. We really look to bring this, what had become a very rigid definition, arbitrarily rigid definition of psychoanalysis that was, you know, really pretty much started in the 1950s in America. We try to really look at the radical origins of psychoanalysis. Look at Freud's progressive vision, his vision of bringing psychoanalysis to the masses, opening free clinics, treating the poor, all things that in America in the 1950s were, you know, dissociated onto psychotherapy and the social workers.
There's a quote here actually from you guys on this topic. We would argue that one is using well-developed psychoanalytic ideas to work with a patient less frequently, then applying psychoanalysis in that way is just as much a utilization of psychoanalysis as any other approach.
Well, the only way I would want to complicate it and spin it around a little bit is that, in a certain way, I think that it actually calls on us, in terms of training and educating psychoanalysts, to be more rigorous and, in some ways, not looser, but even more disciplined and more rigorous. And it's a harder job in the sense that, to the degree that so much depends on how much is the individual analyst and that individual patient, what's going on between them, to the degree that that becomes a new factor that wasn't studied in the classical model, because the classical model assumed a neutral, anonymous analyst, where analysts were just about interchangeable. To the degree that we have to factor in the subjectivity and intersubjectivity of both partners, the learning of psychoanalysis has become more complicated than it used to be. In addition to the fact that we have such a plurality of theories, that now you're not only studying many theories and having to sort out what theory works for you, you're also having to sort out how it fits who you are and how you express yourself as an analyst with a particular kind of patient. In a certain way, I think that makes the demands of analytic training and analytic education, we need to be even more rigorous. So just as a quick example in terms of the questions you've asked, as it's come up so much about numbers, I would be against any analytic training only allowing once a week, as much as an analytic institute that required only 3 or 4 times a week. And the same thing about the couch or the chair. It seems to me students today have to learn how to work with people once a week, 3 times a week, 4 times a week, on the couch, on the chair, on the treadmill, and learn for themselves what works for them, what works with particular patients, and really figure out what theory makes sense given their practice with who they are. That's a lot to learn. That's a complicated task. And it means, in a certain way, we need to be more rigorous, not less.
You just said something about, something about perhaps it was intersubjectivity, the mutual subjectivities, right, of the two parties. So I have a question about that, because here we're not, CMTS, we're not really thinking about the subjectivity of the analyst very much in our work, in terms of how it is that we ourselves are a part of the picture. And so I have a question, and it's a little long, there's a backup to it, so I'll just read it out. Okay. I sense that born of a desire to solidify the relational turn, the book at times presumes certain overarching changes to psychoanalysis. There are moments in which I read the book and I thought, that's not the psychoanalysis I know. In writing about basic model technique, right, from back in the day, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, I didn't have to do that, thank goodness. The authors write, contrast this with psychoanalysis in our postmodern constructivist age, in which the nature of the analyst's authority and the teacher's and supervisor's authority has become less clear. In another sentence, we read that psychoanalytic theory and practice, quote, are highlighting issues of multiplicity of the self and the connection of multiple self states to fragmentation and dissociation. Such statements gave me pause to pause. Having just completed 10 years of training here at the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies, the analyst's authority is not something, for instance, that we think much about, nor is multiplicity or the idea of multiple self-states. And I sense these ideas are born from the attention paid to postmodernism, which I appreciate, but many schools of psychoanalysis aren't working through a postmodern lens. So in the book, there's moments where there's this assumption. I thought, you know, for moderns or Lacanians, the analyst is responsible for keeping the treatment going, right? There's no co-creation. The buck stops with the analyst. The analyst is working to resolve the resistances. The analyst's subjectivity is ultimately, for certain approaches, not so interesting. It's not my sense that Lacanians, moderns, contemporary ego analysts, there's like three left, or Bolas, or Reed, or Anzu, or McDougall have been too much interested in this mode of thinking. So when making statements such as the aforementioned, the relational perspective is made a bit normative. Ayúdame, por favor. Like, what's up? What's going on with that? God?
Just a very short thought, which is that it's interesting because the relational approach started off as counter-normative, and at postdoc, it's the biggest track right now. It's the most popular. It actually has become kind of the normative position in a way, even though we have three tracks. The relational is by far kind of the most establishment.
Yeah, Luke, I will elaborate on a little
Please
more.
Do.
There was a day when Steve Mitchell said to me, and when I said to him, what are we going to do if the relational position becomes dominant? He says, well, we'll just have to start a new track. But I think...
Would that be the modern?
Well, you know, that I was going to say something about the moderns, but let me say a little bit more elaborate on Karen, and I'll come back to the modern. It's very, very interesting at NYU because the relational track is, in a certain way, the dominant track in the sense of offering the most core students attracted to it, for the most students, supervisees. But that's not what's most interesting. What's most interesting is that as you look at the reading lists, the syllabi of the courses across all the tracks, including the Freudian track, the relational track, the interpersonal track, and the independent track, the course readings are more and more drawing on the same sources, more and more similar, and you're absolutely right. There is no Lacanian position there. We offer one course on Lacan, which runs once in a while, so that really doesn't exist there. The community is Freudian, personal, relational, and independent, and there is more and more of a mainstream, and the mainstream is a relational, intersubjective mainstream. So I think you're absolutely right. In regard to, and of course, you know, my audience that I usually speak to is the IR audience, which is relational group, and Division 39, which is a largely relational group. So I think you're totally right. That's who I write for. That's my audience. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of modern, I would say this. Spotnitz's ideas, I think, were clearly ahead of his time, and there's a great reason for modern analysts to be more integrated now with the mainstream of psychoanalysis. There are, you know, when you say that they don't pay much attention to the subjectivity of the analyst, I would question that because, for example, just the idea that there's a lot of attention paid to the use of countertransference is a form of subjectivity. It may not be the way relational people are using it right now.
What's the difference in your mind between relational therapy and
subjective
countertransference?
Hold on. I know you're faculty, but I'm a graduate now.
To go back to what I was suggesting is that I think there are many things. The use of countertransference is one area where he was ahead of his time, but there are many others. The kinds of questions he was asking about what's going on in the minds of other people is something that's commonly used today, not only in family therapy, but among many relational and intersubjective analysts. There's all kinds of things in terms of what he would have called joining with the resistances that are now common ground among many analytic approaches. But because it was so much not part of the mainstream for so many decades, there is a way now in which I think the moderns have to catch up and rejoin what's happening in the mainstream. So when you point out that in a certain way the book makes assumptions about what's happening in the mainstream that don't apply to the modern, I think you're absolutely right. That's another bridge that can be crossed. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about that here in many ways in at CMPS. I wanted to move to sort of a different area in the book. And the book puts forth, and correct me if I don't capture it, but in part there's an argument about trauma at the heart of the psychoanalytic project, that Freud's thinking is... Freud's theorizing is born of a reaction, in part, to an anti-Semitic surround, beginning with the 1870s, with the rise of the Jews seen as a race. You know, so here he is, and this is the environment in which he's developing his thinking. And I know that trauma is sort of at the heart of a lot of relational thinking, and so I was reading this book and thinking about the trauma in psychoanalysis, the splits, the splitting, the ways in which the emigre analyst came here, fleeing, you know, the Anschluss, fleeing the Holocaust. And so let me just ask you some questions about this. I mean, okay, do you think when we're focusing on trauma and in the clinical encounter, do you think that anything might be lost by the privileging of
a
focus on trauma in the clinical encounter?
Anything might be lost?
Yeah, in other words, you know, we come into the session and we have ideas like what it is that, how we're understanding the patient, how we're understanding, you know, what could be going on. If I'm privileging a trauma, I'm privileging often something that is not intrapsychic, perhaps. It could be external. Very different way of thinking, rather than the patient is, you know, discharging, you know, tension, right? So, I'm wondering, is there anything lost in that focus?
I think, very important question. One of the books I'm editing now with Sue Grand is a book called Relational Analysts, Critique Relational Psychoanalysis, and it's meant to be an affirmative, loving critique from the inside. But this is definitely one of the areas that will come up, and it's an area that we address in the book, because in breaking down binaries, one of the main binaries in our field has been internal and external, trauma or intrapsychic. And my problem is not recognizing the importance of trauma, which I think we have to, and it's been a very important development in psychoanalysis to recognize the role of trauma and to pay attention to the repercussions of trauma that were missed for a long time. I think in the book we take the position it was missed because so many of the early analysts were themselves traumatized, and so they couldn't see beyond their own trauma. So I think it's a very important development that we pay attention to trauma. I think what happens that would be a very big loss would be to give up what we know about intrapsychic developments and to give up focus on the internal world and do a binary flip where now everything is external and everything is trauma. And that's the danger. That's something we have to be very careful about.
Yeah,
but
in our book, excuse me, we the problem is that if a student is taught a history of psychoanalysis, it's always a history of ideas, as if you're just looking at, what are the developments of the concepts in psychoanalysis without any consideration of what the cultural and economic, social context was surrounding its development. And so I understand your question, but our goal was really to correct an imbalance in how we look at psychoanalysis by offering actually what ended up being a cultural history, which was really looking at what were the external forces in the traumatic development of psychoanalysis, in the way we were looking at psychoanalysis like a patient. And doing the psychoanalysis of psychoanalysis.
It may be worth saying, because a lot of people may not have read the book, so just to give a quick sentence or two about this, to remember that the early analysts surrounding Freud were almost all, to a person, Jewish refugees who had fled Poland, Eastern Europe, and had recently come to Vienna, either they themselves or their parents. As Jews in Vienna, they could not get jobs in the hospitals. They couldn't get jobs in the universities. They were working in private practice, not because that was elite. They were working in private practice because that was the only way they could eke out a living. They fled that persecution, and then many of them, or the next generation, fled Hitler. And then psychoanalysis in America is again dramatically affected by a group of immigrants fleeing persecution, who were traumatized and were not in any position, even in their analyses, even when analyzed by other immigrants, other refugees, were not able to deal with the trauma of the Holocaust, were not able to deal with the trauma of immigration. They were in a new country where they barely spoke the language. They often came with no money. Many of them, their families had been wiped out. And this was, they just couldn't deal with it. And so there was a very important phase of the establishment of psychoanalysis, both in Europe and in America. And I think we have to now see that psychoanalysis has its origins in immigration, poverty, prejudice, racism, homophobia, misogyny, trauma.
I'm thinking about this. The book makes an amazing argument. I love, it's like one of my favorite arguments in the book, is thematic defense, ego psychology as a thematic defense. So, just think about it, right? There's a conflict-free zone. One can overcome one's destructive impulses somehow. Because war has just, wiped out millions, but we can master our destructive aspect. And so in their writing, as I understand it, about the development of ego psychology as a manic defense, as a reaction to loss and intense vulnerability, a denial of weakness, it's funny, it's the idea of a conflict-free zone right after this war seems so absurd, but nevertheless. But it's in the post-war period that it seems to me, from what I know about the history of psychoanalysis, and that just makes me think about Spotted, we went two ways. One way we went, which is to the New York psychoanalytic, Hartman, Chris, Lonsdien, etc. The other way, though, was at pretty much the same time, we see Spotnitz, Frieda von Reichman, Harold Searles, Harris Stack Sullivan, and they turn their attention to schizophrenia and the psychoses. In this book, I don't think we heard as much about this other vein, this vein that led analysts to Austin Riggs, Chestnut Hill, the Jewish Board, for Spotnitz. How do you account for this impulse, and What happened to it? I mean, because we can all define ourselves in opposition to New York psychoanalytic, it's fabulous, straw man, really easy. And there are, how many ego psychologists are left? It's like Fred Bush, there's one, you know, there's almost no one. But all these analysts really were working with psychosis. Yeah?
I think the first thing to say is that, with the exception of Spotnitz, who you put into that group, those become the forerunners of relational psychoanalysis. So, and that's one of the reasons, in other words, we're describing the mainstream, but our mainstream of relational really has its roots in the interpersonal tradition, as well as in the British object relations tradition. So in the American version of that, it is in fact Sullivan from Reichman.
Searles.
And Searles. You know, Searles, I'll tell you a story that's relevant to this. The story I can tell you about Searles is that when Greenberg and Mitchell wrote the object relations book, classic 1983 work, Searles was very hurt that he wasn't mentioned. And he called Steve. Now, Searles was Steve Mitchell's hero. And Steve couldn't believe he had left him out. And so he was very apologetic. And he wondered, why did I leave Searles out? Like, how come he didn't? Because he was hugely influential to Steve. And what Steve realized was that it was a product of his having written the book with Jay by schools of thought, that it went from the Freudians to the ego psychologists to the interpersonalists to the Fairbairn to the Winnicott, and that Searles didn't fit neatly, even in the interpersonal. And that because he didn't fit neatly in the schools, he wasn't on the agenda. But I did an article some years back, you may know, where I compare Searles and Ferenczi, which I had the chance to work with Searles on. And he had never read Ferenczi because of just what you're bringing up. He said he was taught that Ferenczi didn't work with psychotic patients, so he wouldn't read it. But of course, Ferenczi did work with psychotic patients and was a leader in working with people that other people considered unanalyzable. When Searles heard that, he was eager to go back and read Ferenczi. He loved the article, but by then he was deteriorating. And,
wow.
Yeah.
Did you like working with him?
It was just such an honor to talk to him at all, you know.
I wasn't around. I'm very jealous. I was like, I love Searles too. I was thinking about two analysts writing history. It's very interesting. You're not trained as an historian secretly, are you?
No.
Okay. Just wanted to check. Because I was thinking about what is it? What happens when analysts turn our attention, as we often do, you know, with the paintings in the room, for instance. I mean, you know, or people are doing many different things. But when analysts write history, what historians do you like? Who are you drawn to as a historian? Who is your model? I know that, you know, you talk about Mitchell and Greenberg being influenced by Isaiah Berlin. Oh my God, that was funny. I had no idea, but who do you love? Who did you draw from?
Well, from my end, my greatest interest was in the area of Jewish studies. And we drew heavily from Sandra Gilman, from Daniel Boyarin, Celia Brickman and Andrew Holly, Yerushalmi, yes.
Major.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, these are largely actually not historians per se, but cultural historians,
right.
People writing cultural studies. Now, I think we both read a lot of history and we're both interested in general in history, but I think for this, it really had to do with this cultural, socio-political angle. Now, within psychoanalysis, psychoanalysts have always written history, but I think of books like George McCary's book as being an important historical source book.
But a lot of the psychoanalytic histories are also not written by psychoanalysts, right? We have Hale,
right.
Obviously, and
Which we belong to.
After Freud left, which is John Byrne's collection, which I edited it.
I interviewed
him.
So I edited it. So I'm editing your book now.
One thing I want to add to your question, even though you didn't really ask it, is that it was such a pleasure for me, and I know it's a pleasure for Lou, to really look at other disciplines and consider psychoanalysis in light of other disciplines, like anthropology, like women's studies, like feminism and a feminist theory and Jewish studies and history. And, you know, to have a dialogue of psychoanalysis with these other fields is what will keep psychoanalysis really vibrant. Because, you know, it's interesting because in other fields, people are very interested in psychoanalysis, but less so in psychology nowadays. So the Academy is very interested in psychoanalysis, but traditionally there hasn't been much of a dialogue between psychoanalysis and the Academy, which is what I actually value very much about postdoc, which is that it's positioned in the university, and you know, I know Lou has a program that he's set up with.
Karen's referring to an interdisciplinary Freud studies group, yeah, where we meet with academics from all different areas. And basically read one Freud piece together and discuss it from different angles.
You know, at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, there's a side D in psychoanalysis and culture that I may one day complete. I have a question for you guys. I'm thinking about, in regard to the influence of other disciplines on psychoanalysis. I'm thinking about Jessica Benjamin, Neural Dinan, or a postdoc there trained in other disciplines before they became analysts. And I wonder, is there a risk of bringing too much culture into the consulting room and so diminishing the interpsychic? For instance, the tenets of social work, you know, the respect for cultural difference, looking at the impact of the environment on the patient. Is that coming to take some precedence in the relational turn? I mean, I interviewed Muriel, you know, with Culture in Mind, and it was a book that I thought, I wasn't sure, I was looking for the interpsychic a little bit, I was looking for it, and it wasn't so clear. So, Eric, what do you think about that?
I understand the danger.
You'll just keep answering.
I understand the concern. But I would go back to the main theme of the book, which is deconstructing binaries. And I think that as soon as we pose the question in terms of that one will take away from the other, that's exactly the kind of oppositional thinking that we want to try and find a third to get beyond. So as soon as you're positioning it as will the external take away from the internal, it's that kind of opposition. I think any good clinician needs to be thinking both about intrapsychic forces, dynamics, the unconscious, unconscious fantasy, and they need to be thinking about the place of culture and society, and to think that a clinician could do one and not the other, or that one takes away from the other, I would want to reverse all of that and say one enriches the other, and it's a matter of education and thinking and training to be able to do that.
I agree. I don't look at it at all as
a binary thinker.
I really don't look at it at all as one taking away the other. I just couldn't think of working any other way but considering all of the factors, internal, external, intrapsychic, I couldn't work any other way. Sorry.
So it's okay, just so exciting to think about. Okay, I have to ask this question too. Here at the house of the outsiders, outsiders behind the spot that's inspired, the relational school does appear to occupy the spot.
And in the book, which I agree with his argument, that there's optimal marginality, that psychoanalysis, you know, lives or dies on the basis of being optimally marginal. You know, Freud, as they both write about, was optimally marginal. He was both German and Jew. He was insider and outsider, an enlightened man, but a man also steeped in service, you know. How's the relational school going to maintain the optimal marginality if the move is toward? I mean, how? It's a question. What happens? Your whole faculty is waiting to hear this answer. So,
psychoanalysis, you know, in a certain way, we all have to keep in mind just the place of where psychoanalysis is in the culture. I'll tell you a story. I just came back from teaching in London, and I was talking with a group of analysts in London, historians, actually not an analyst, one of them was a historian doing research on psychoanalysis in London. And we were talking about the controversial discussions and just how important the controversial discussions are. These are the debates that were staged between Anna Freud and Melanie Klein during World War II, and how important they are in the history of psychoanalysis and the debates between the Americans and the British. And the historian said she had been working on digging up archives about the controversial discussions, and that the candidates at the Institute during the controversial discussions had never heard of them and didn't know what they were. And nobody outside of the British psychoanalytic even knew what the controversial discussions were. So this idea that our trivial battles between one school and another has any long-term effect on the history of the world is, I think, really absurd. We have nothing to worry about thinking we're mainstream. We are so not close to being mainstream.
We haven't been at home.
Sorry.
His bust is usually up there with different looking pockets. That's Dr. Turner's work, isn't it?
But just to add to that, to really emphasize that really what brought us to write this book is the crisis that psychoanalysis is now in the larger world. We are so marginalized that just to elaborate on that, the idea of relational psychoanalysis being in hegemony is like where?
Well, here, maybe. Yes, here.
And, you know, just to pick up on that, looking at the audience, and I don't know most of the audience, but it is largely white. I mean, there are maybe a couple of ethnic people here, but it is basically a white group. That is true at every psychoanalytic meeting we go to. There are a few exceptions, and that has to change. We're living in America. This is a country of great diversity, of great immigration. How can we think we're going to be mainstream if we don't represent the people? And one of the challenges for psychoanalysis is how do we make it more diverse in every which way? And that's part of what we were trying to evoke when we used Freud's expression, a psychotherapy for the people. That psychoanalysis needs to be a psychotherapy for the people. But it needs to be for all the people. It needs to be for a representative group of the United States. And it's not now. And it seems to me it's not at any of our little orientations that argue with each other over fairly trivial things. Analysts have a great deal in common with each other across schools. We spend so much of our energy fighting over disagreements about things that may be important that we overlook how much we have in common.
Okay, so as I read the book, right, I was thinking it's very compelling because I feel like, oh, there's room perhaps for my way of working and thinking. Then I wondered, and what I wondered is, would I have to give up on my interest in the drives in order to get on board? And I'll elaborate on this question a little bit. Because I like that you are arguing for the expansion of the boundaries of what can be considered psychoanalysis. I think that's crucial.
And as you're right, we must pause to drive home our point once again, how we define psychoanalysis, this is the authors, how we define psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is up to us, is a pragmatic decision. As a profession, we can define psychoanalysis in any way we believe serves the interests of our community and the wider public. There is no true definition of psychoanalysis, the authors write. There is only the manner in which we construct the definition. So it sounds like a very worthy project, and yet I felt uneasy. I wondered about my not fully embracing the argument, and I'll tell you about my disease to some degree, and I would like to hear your thoughts. I wonder, for instance, I don't think about dissociation, okay? I think, you know, about repression, unconscious things, and think really differently. I don't think in a two-person model. I just don't, you know, not me, like I'm not like, you know, I just don't, it's not how I've been analyzed, it's not how I've been trained, it's not how I've been supervised. So I have some reservations. Like, I like your idea of it expanding what it is to work, what it means to work analytically, but I'm not so comfortable with the disregard for the drives that I sense in the total argument. And I feel tempted to jump up your bandwagon, and just as you were saying before, like, you know, this, you sort of, you use this example, you guys write, we're on the Titanic, the ship is sinking, the ship called psychoanalysis is sinking, and we're rearranging the chairs. But while I have to give up the, my interest in the drives to get on board.
Not at all.
It, to get on board which ship is the question. In other words, to get on board the ship of psychoanalysis, I hope that ship has lots of levels and rooms with lots of different theories.
And there would be room. Deck, right?
Yeah, there would be, you know, there would be room on that ship for all kinds of theories. To get on a ship called, you know, relational psychoanalysis, even there, I would argue there's much more room for diversity than you're expressing. For example, Jay Greenberg certainly considers himself a relational analyst. I consider him a relational analyst. He has written a whole book arguing that you can't have a theory without drives. Steve Mitchell himself, although drives became the thing that were excluded from his relational theory, nevertheless, he writes very clearly that if you define drives the way modern analytic thinkers were, modern meaning contemporary, not modern, so, for example, he mentions Kernberg or Joe Sandler and their drive theories. And he says that their drive theories have been so transformed that there's nothing in them that would contradict even Sullivan's reluctance to accept any drives. So I think we're getting to a discussion that requires much more nuance of exactly what is the onboard what and exactly what's meant by drive. And it's a complicated discussion.
I was in the book when you write with ego psychologists, you know, you really say, you know, they rejected the death drive, right? And something that, you know, here at CNPS we embrace very wholeheartedly. And in the book, Kernberg is quoted, who suggests that this rejection is a manifestation of a general tendency in ego psychology to downplay the primitivity of sexuality and aggression. And this is Kernberg, they're quoting here in the book. Quote, a sanitized version of Freud was suitable. He keeps looking like he knows what I'm going to say. Anyway, the quote from Kernberg is, a sanitized version of Freud was suitable. It should be two or four acceptance by the conventional American culture of its day. Could it be said that, at times, the relational position with its attention to infant research, attachment, and then attachment and trauma is also offering perhaps a more palatable version of the human condition, and hence we can accord everybody running toward the relational with a domestication, perhaps?
My sense is
we're losing a little something.
No. Thank you.
I thought you asked Chris Marty. And if you don't like the question, you should. talking about that too. Well, Trey is a modern analyst.
I'll say two things. First, I completely agree. Every theory is defense against something else. There's every theory is a compromise formation. It expresses something and it hides something. It communicates something and it keeps something hidden. So there's no theory that wouldn't have that. But I think you in a certain way read the book with the wrong preoccupation. The book isn't about relational psychoanalysis. There's almost not a chapter in it about relational. And we didn't even discuss relational in any systematic way. The book is about psychoanalysis in general and contemporary psychoanalysis, which we do think has been largely influenced by relational. But it's not a book about relational. The book is a book about psychoanalysis and psychotherapy and psychoanalysis to the people. In a certain way, from so many of the questions that are geared towards the relational, that's not, I think, what we really had in mind in writing it.
Yes, like I read this book as it struck me as, because where it ends up in the last chapter,
you're right. We talk about we do. It's by no means a polemic for relational psychoanalysis. That was not at all our intention. There are quite a number of pieces about relational psychoanalysis, especially when we talk about the importance of recognizing our own vulnerability. And because that plays such a big part of the thinking right now in relational psychoanalysis, and where we talk about paradox and dialectics. But we talk about that because it's so important to our idea about deconstructing binaries. We spend a lot of time on dialectics, and dialectics is something that relational psychoanalysis and theorizing spends a lot of time on.
But we were actually very careful that it not be a polemic for relational,
right?
Because we're both writing in a certain way representing a community that is Freudian, relational, interpersonal, and independent. So we really tried to cover that. Actually, the last chapter that you mentioned, the two main stars of that chapter are Tom Ogden and Owen Mack, neither of whom, although they've been influential in the relational book, neither of them identify themselves as relational.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know. I got to the end of the book and I thought to myself, I wrote something here. I thought, no, this is a strange question. The return of the repressed in my notes. Are you, meaning the authors, arguing that once we have, is relational analysis the kind of return of the repressed once we've worked through the impact of anti-Semitism on the thinking of the field? Because I do think I felt that as a steady argument throughout, that what Freud, part of the argument, which I think is compelling, is that when Freud is developing, for instance, the the theory of castration anxiety or the Oedipal, he's having a deal I'll read a quote from the book. The author's right, it's much easier to understand why Freud constructed the Oedipus complex as the nucleus of neurosis and castration anxiety as bedrock when he realized that his people, Jews, were accused of being neurotic and perverse because of generations of incest, and that Jewish men were viewed by others and by themselves as castrated and effeminate because they were circumcised. In Freud's transformation, rather than Jews being incestuous, we all have Oedipal desires. It is not Jews who are castrated, parenthetically circumcised. We all have castration anxiety. Rather than Jews being primitive and perverse, we all have these aspects of our unconscious. And I got a sense in the book that, Freud was contending continuously with antisemitism. And it, I'm not here to contest that. But when we work through this idea that Freud is interested in sort of autonomy and independence and being a Jewish man and not being seen as hysterical, and being independent and phallic and hard, right? I don't know, I guess I'm...
What's interesting, I mean, I'm trying to follow the flow of your thinking as you're doing it. I think actually you're hitting on that. I do think this is the core of the book, and I think you're getting it right. I wouldn't categorize that in terms of relational. I would categorize that, and I think the real heart of the book This is about the intersection, the interrelationship, the interinfluence of racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, misogyny. And what you're capturing in describing Freud in this way is about anti-Semitism, but it's also about the role of his need to be masculine, the projection of everything else on women, the repudiation of femininity as what he calls bedrock. And in terms of what we were saying before about all of the other fields and disciplines and the impact of history, really what I was going to say is it's not history per se that's been the influence. It's largely been the field of feminist studies. I mean, if anything has had an impact on the world of psychoanalysis that Karen and I are coming from, the relational world, the NYU world, the contemporary psychoanalytic world, there is nothing like feminism that's affected psychoanalysis. And I think what you're reading is this is the impact of feminism, queer theory, post-colonial studies. It's way beyond just postmodernism as a philosophical position. And that's the heart of it. Now, it is true, and here's, I'll come back to the relationality, it is true that the relational school, having evolved later, it evolved in the 1980s, was deeply influenced by feminism, queer theory, and post-colonial studies. And so there is that intersection.
You feel 1968.
Yeah, absolutely. That's when Steve Mitchell and Jay Greenberg were undergraduates. That's when they were reading Nietzsche and fighting the Vietnam War, and absolutely, that is in the heart.
Yeah, I would just to add to that, I think that you're actually touching on something that, so an answer to your question is that the return of the repressed. Certainly, in some way, that is our contention, because what we write about in the book is how the Jewish man in the virulent anti-Semitic society in which Freud and the early analysts lived was looked at as a woman. You know, it was feminized. The Jewish man was considered not a real man. And so we write about how Freud worked very hard to represent himself and his theory as masculine and phallic and penetrating and dissociated the feminine. And this is, you know, so... And project, and it, we show how in the 1950s, when psychoanalysis was at the height of its power, again, psychoanalysis was seen as masculine and penetrating, and all that was feminine and relational and supportive was pushed onto psychotherapy. And so, yes, it is in a way, we're looking at opening all of that up and looking at what the reverberations are of this dissociation of the repudiation of femininity. I mean, Freud wrote that the bedrock of psychoanalysis is the repudiation of femininity, which means that men have to repudiate their desire to be, you know, men have to repudiate their femininity and women have to repudiate their desire to have a penis.
So I think that we're just about at a point. People need to discharge here. Pass the microphone around. And we're at a point now where I've done a lot of questions. So we're going to open up to the audience. What we need to do is somehow pass the microphone around. I'm happy to. You want to? Okay, great. Ms. Rosianne, you had your hand up first.
I think I can talk pretty loud. But, okay.
No, but you need to be recorded. And what should
be recorded?
My name is
Lisa Rosina. So I was just wondering what you think about this. We just read in class an article by Freud, The Female Sexuality, and he talks about how the male has one sex organ, the penis, and the woman has two, the torus and the vagina. So in your book, you talk about the old female healers who both gave treatment and cure. So I was wondering if there's any connection with that because it seems like the women in the old days could provide treatment and care and cure, and that the men can only give this treatment, or that it's sort of been, what you thought about that?
Well, we read about in the book that, yes, originally the majority of healers were women, but that as
medicine became an established profession, women were shut out, and only men were allowed to be doctors. And as we write about in the 1920s, especially with the, you know, when people first started out being doctors in America, anyone could be a doctor. It didn't require any particular training. With the Flexner Report in the 1920s, when it would, you know, the establishment of medical schools with real medical training happened, women were shut out, blacks were shut out, and it became a primarily white male profession. As antibiotics came in and with the development of antibiotics, all of a sudden, and medicines like penicillin and various other things, all of a sudden doctors could offer cure. They could actually do something to cure the patient. Whereas they weren't really interested before this in providing care and support, which the women healers did both. They might help a woman deliver a baby and then they would come live in and help her nurse the baby.
The only thing I would want to add to that is just to reinforce what I was saying before about feminism and to tie it back to your question about history. Because we got a lot. This is one. We got a lot. Does that work?
Yeah.
Sure.
We relied very heavily on Barbara Ehrenreich's studies. Barbara Ehrenreich's a feminist historian, and she really was the one that we got this idea from of the split between treatment and care as something that was split, gendered between men and women. And of course, we then related that to the way in which psychoanalysis defined itself as in opposition to psychotherapy, very much along the lines of what you're describing, what Barbara Ehrenreich was describing, as the split between treatment. Once doctors felt that they could offer treatment, they didn't want to offer care. And then that's projected out on women, social workers.
Okay,
so
Dr. Say your name, please.
I'm Pamela Armstrong-Manchins. So I have actually two comments. First, it's just a comment and the other is a question. When you're talking about binaries, you're talking about intrapsychic and culture, I thought, well, how did Freud get to understand the intrapsychic? Well, it was from all of his readings of the culture. And he read everything. So maybe they're not too separate. Okay, so my question is, when we have these kinds of discussions and we talk about the definition of psychoanalysis, I notice that Freud's definition of psychoanalysis is never mentioned. What's always mentioned is frequency. So I just want to re-quote, I was going to say it by memory, but I think I'm going to quote what Freud said, and get to the right paper. In 1914, in the history of the psychoanalytic movement. So he said, any line of investigation which recognizes these two factors, and he had just said what they were in the previous sentence, which is transference and resistance. So any line of investigation which recognizes these two factors, transference and resistance, and takes them as their starting point of its work, has a right to call itself psychoanalysis, even though it arrives at results other than my own. I guess my first question is, why is that definition of Freud's never mentioned? And what do you all think about that definition?
A number of things. First, I would hope, I encourage you to read the book. The book quotes the definition and discusses psychoanalysis, not at all in terms of frequency. The whole point of the book is that frequency was used as a way of dichotomizing something that is clearly the fact that you can do it once a week, twice a week, three times a week, four times a week, shows that there's a continuum. And yet, it was dichotomized into psychotherapy or psychoanalysis. So the whole point of the book is actually to re-examine that definition. And part of what we show is that, in fact, there's good empirical data to show that analytic therapists all do quite a lot in common, and that there's a lot that holds us together as psychoanalysts that has nothing to do with frequency or the couch. So I do think that if you look at the book, you'll see that people do mention it. In terms of one other thing, and then I'll stop, but the chapter in particular that relates to what you're saying about how did Freud come to this idea about the intrapsychic versus the interpersonal. First of all, intrapsychic is not a word Freud ever used. If you look at the index of Freud's writings or Buchheb search, Freud didn't call them intrapsychic. It was Sullivan who used the word intrapsychic to refer to Kraepelin, because his interpersonal was in opposition to Kraepelin. So this whole idea of intrapsychic wasn't the, and for that matter, Freud also didn't differentiate psychoanalysis from psychoanalytic therapy. That's not a distinction he had any interest in. That's all in America post-World War II. The history of all of this is traced in the book. And finally, what we trace, which goes way beyond earlier than Freud, is that this idea of a one-person model or an intrapsychic model versus a two-person or field theory model is something that actually was the basis of the debate between Charcot and Bernheim, and that Freud was extremely familiar with this whole history and could not accept the point of view that that people influence each other all the time. This went against the grain of Freud because he was trying to distance himself from the shtetl where people influenced each other and life was with people. So he developed his model of interior of the mind with boundaries as a way of having a bounded mind rather than a relational mind. We trace the history of that pretty carefully too. So hopefully you get a chance to look at it.
Hi, I'm Jack Crane. I have several questions. The question that Tracy brought up in the very early part of this, how can I know when I'm doing psychoanalysis? That is a question I think I have that sometimes, and I suspect other people do too. So you mentioned a little a big bulk of suites and chambers and levels, but they're probably down the dock. There's another boat. So there's got to be something that characterizes psychoanalysis. The impression I have now, being so ecumenical, which I, by the way, I'm sure everybody here also is enthused by, is that psychoanalysis begins to sound a little like pornography, in that you know it when you see it, but you can't. So I want to ask you, if you're not putting you on the spot too much, if you could say, what is psychoanalysis? No. Pamela did say what Freud said, transference and resistance are the core concepts of a psychoanalytic approach. You mentioned that it's in the book, but you didn't say you agree that that's the fundamental part of psychoanalysis. Now, the second question I want to ask you.
But you wanted to answer the first one?
No. Could you tell us, because I know you're focusing on this book, which is an ecumenical plea, is what I understand. But I think you have a whole group of modern analysts here. You're one of the main expositors of relational psychotherapy, or psychoanalysis, whatever. And I think you're missing a terrible opportunity not to hear you say a little something about that. And I'll tell you what I want you to say. Taking these two concepts of transference and resistance, my understanding of the relational approach is that there's no man is an island, and there's no such thing as an analyst. Like Winnicott said, there's no such thing as a baby without a mother. There's no such thing as an analyst without a patient. And everything that happens in that room is created by the two parties in interaction. Everything is co-creating. The patient's transference is co-created. The patient's resistance is co-creating, and the analyst has a counter-transference, which may be objectively induced, may be subjectively due to his history, whatever it is. Now, I also want to say that I agree with what you said earlier, that modern analysts are very interested in the animal subjectivity. However, and this is where we come to a kind of a defining point. My understanding is the way the relational people want to deal with all these issues is they want, if the analyst has some subjective issue that's contributing to what's going on in the treatment, he consults with the patient. He says that the patient is able, my understanding of the reading is, that the patient can see the analyst not only as well as the analyst can see the patient, but in the writing it often sounds like the patient can see the analyst without distortion, and the analyst is the one who's got some problems. Now, we all recognize that analysts do have problems and bring them into the treatment situation, but we would not assume that we can discuss these issues in a spirit of mutuality with our patients. Maybe because our patients are crazier, but very few of our patients, I live with this one, many of our patients are neither want that mutuality or are capable of that kind of mutuality. So our way of dealing with it, and here I don't want to sound arrogant, is to consult somebody else, to go to a supervisor, to go to a peer group. And my impression is that modern analysts do much more supervision well into their careers, get much more than any other group. Most of the faculty here, I guess, it used to be in the case, still get supervision, still go for supervision. So the idea is that we think we have to bring this problem to somebody else who's not in that mix. So there's my two questions. What is psychoanalysis? What is relational psychoanalysis in relation specifically?
But Spock had sometimes talked about consulting the patient.
Oh, yeah. Consulting the patient is okay, but it's not enough, and it's not something you can draw on. That's our point.
Well, that's
okay. I'm going to give you the short version on one foot, right? The first thing I would say, this goes back to something I hinted at before when I said that the different schools have more in common than they have separate from them. There are a core group of things that all analytic therapists do. We know this not only because their books say they do it and their articles say they do it. We know it because when they're assessed by outside researchers, it's observed that they do it. The manuals that they devise, when they do devise manuals, reflect the same things. So the principles are not just principles they're espousing. We know that there's a lot in common among analytic therapists by what they say they do, what they're observed to do, what they abstract in their manuals. It's consistent, and it fits broad analytic theory. And there are things that where there may be minor differences between schools, the bulk of it is the same across schools. Like, we don't come in with structured questions and do a structured interview. We listen open-endedly to what people say, which gives them room, call it free association or whatever you want to call it, gives them room to express themselves. You say resistance. One of the main findings is that analytic therapists listen for affect, for emotion, and pay particular attention to the defenses against it. How is it kept out? Traditional idea of resistance. They pay all analytic therapists, not relational, not modern, not Freudian, not Jungian, all analytic therapists, listen for patterns from the past, what's happening in the world on the outside, what's happening in the transference in the relationship, and try and form patterns among them. So analytic therapists are listening for the themes in the life, particularly around affective issues and the defenses against them. That's a heck of a lot of common ground that we have in common. Now, we may disagree. One school may say put more emphasis on the here and now, and the other one puts a little more emphasis on the past. But they're both looking at both and looking at the patterns there. My point is, there's a lot of rich common ground of what all analytic schools have in common. I think that it makes sense for us to balance our fights and disagreements with a recognition of how much common ground there is. In terms of the other question is, of course, a huge question because it has to do with really explaining the fundamental premises of relational psychoanalysis. It's really, and so what I'll do there is just give you one example of the nuance, and I encourage you on this to look at my first book, A Meeting of Minds. the whole purpose of that book was when you said that, you know, it's not all mutual, or the whole purpose of that book was to do a detailed study of what do we mean by mutual, and to see that some things are mutual and some things are not. For example, we differentiate mutual regulation, two people influencing each other, from mutual recognition of two people recognizing each other as separate subjects. That's different from mutual generation of associations and data, which is different from mutual resistances that we're locked in. Each kind of mutuality has to be studied separately and has to be weighed against asymmetry. The idea that there's a difference in power between the patient and the analyst, they're there for different reasons, different functions, different goals, different purposes. My answer is simply to say this is an enormously complex and subtle point about, is everything mutual? Is it mutually constructed? I would say mutual what? And the first book is an effort to look in some detail at the nuances of all those different kinds of mutuality. So these are not simple matters. This is the kind of thing that we could take, you know, years to explore.
Tracy, now that you've had a chance not only to read...
What's your name?
Oh, I'm Liz Weiss.
Hi, Liz Weiss.
Hi, Tracy. Now that you've had a chance to read the book and speak with Karen and Lou, I want to bring the tilt back to psychotherapy for the people. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about that, now that you've had a chance to really, you know, sort of open that up and hear a lot of details from each of them.
What, I'm not sure.
What it means for you, or what your understanding of that being the major or premise of the book, which has come up several times. Thanks.
I guess I'm still not sure I fully understand the question, but I think what you're asking is, having listened to the authors further elaborate on their ideas, do I have a different take?
No, just your take.
Oh, my take? Well, I like the book. You know what I mean? I think it's a challenging book. It's an interesting book. I mean, I think there's many. The book is so damn rich. It, like, has so many veins. This is, like, my sense of reading. I was like, well, there's two chapters which we didn't discuss, right? I mean, just, you know, there's only so much time. And there's which I heard Lou give at the Division 39, Freud, Ferenczi, Schreber, Three Wandering Jews, which is a brilliant and lovely, amazing chapter that I think just stands on its own and is worth a read, on the tensions between Freud and Ferenczi, and their Ferenczi's desire for recognition by Freud and Freud's distanciation from him. I mean, it's really something else. Then there's the incredibly exciting chapter, which I think you guys have presented on, which is, you know, the female
genital
stimulation. Dr. Palin mentioned it to me, in fact, right at the beginning, right before we got started, about that chapter, which is incredible, which is really completely fascinating. It's original historical research. So, it's a vast book. I mean, I could have taken any number of paths through it. You know, there are very many paths one could take through a book that's doing as much as this book is doing. Yes. Dr. Chaptel, would you mind to pass the
In relation to the topic of psychoanalysis.
What's your name?
Sarah Chaptel. I'm a modern analyst affiliated with the center. And in relation to the theme of psychoanalysis for the people, Adler, certainly, there were many, as you know, many of those early analysts, Adler and Wilhelm Reich, and I think others were leftists, and they certainly wanted psychoanalysis for the people. Now, I want to give you a little bit of the history of psychoanalysis. The war was traumatic. It was a horrible trauma. And this, what happened to these analysts who were the refugees, some of them went to England, some of them came to America, and they were heartbreaking, the exchanges, because England could absorb just so many, and the States, there was only one institute, New York Psychoanalytic, and Brill was an incredibly controlling individual. And to my mind, the problem was not the trauma before, but the medicalization of psychoanalysis. The psychoanalysts at New York Psychoanalytic absolutely defied when totally against what Freud stood for. They rejected the death instinct. They rejected the paper on the analysis. They rejected so many of these things. Nunberg wrote developed a new theory, ecology. The way of killing the father was for them to invent their own meta theory, and they did it. Rado split off and he created Columbia, and he too, he was very socially oriented. Karen Horney with the Inland Psychoanalytic established her institute, and she was furious with Freud about feminist issues. So I think that it was the most serious problem, really, was the medicalization of psychoanalysis. I mean, there are wars all the time, there are conflicts all the time, but that medicalization is what destroyed psychoanalysis and stood in its way.
Can I make a comment about that? So, from reading that, my understanding is that that medicalization was stimulated by prejudice in this way. So he decided to study Freud some and came back home and he was very excited going to bring back psychoanalysis. The only psychiatrists in New York were WASP. He was the only Jewish person. And so it's said that he felt in order to sell psychoanalysis, he had to change a lot of it, including getting rid of all Leah analysts, and change a lot of psychoanalysis so that it would be accepted by Rudolph.
I don't think we can go into it in much more detail other than to say that I do hope both of you will look at the book. There are at least 3 or 4 chapters specifically on the relationship between the medicalization of psychoanalysis, the development of medicine in this country, the development of psychiatry within medicine, the development of psychoanalysis within psychiatry, the relationship of this to both Judaism and to men and women. It's carefully traced.
Dr. Cameron, did you have a question?
I've
been waiting a long time.
Dr. Cameron asked the question better than more elaborately than I was going to do. Thank you, Jeff. But I still, just briefly, my analysis consider the counter-transference, subjective and objective. We know we have biases and we relate to the therapist. And even though classical analysis was considered one person analysis and then one person delivery, modern analysis always been a two-person treatment. So I don't really know the difference between relational therapy and modern analysis. Do you have any medical distinction between? Because for me, it seems very similar. To me, I've always been modern analysis and relational at the same time, and it's never been a conflict.
People integrate and synthesize from a wide range of theories and can integrate and synthesize theories that are sometimes to other people look contradictory. So I don't have any doubt that you've picked things that for you work and that it's synthetic. But we also are hearing that at least some people here don't feel like it's a two-person psychology, don't think that it emphasizes the subjectivity and the subjectivity in the same way. So it seems to me within each school there's room for some debate about what defines that school, how people work. And that's certainly true, I would say, within the relational community. There are relational analysts who are much closer to British object relations theory. There are relational analysts who are closer to American interpersonal theory. It's a wide range. It's a very broad umbrella. And it seems to me, from what I'm hearing, that that would be true of modern as well.
You know, in response, I would say that classical analysis is a one-person therapy, but a modern treatment is a relational theory.
I just want to say that I know Tracy Morgan, and what you said earlier is not true. She's very interested in the analyst subjectivity. When she's the analyst, and in the theory is I don't know what point she was trying to make then, but she went a little far out.
I could be hyperbolic. Are you saying
yes.
that?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, one thing I just want to mention that I thought was interesting when doing research is that Freud, in his letters to Fleece, talked about a patient that he was treating, a case of male hysteria, that helped him understand his own case of hysteria. Would we call him a relational analyst?
My name is Ken Hector. I just have a question. I think does your book touch at all on the role of economics and all these fights? We look from the modern times, the haves always want to keep on the have nots. And we see that when psychologists want to do, let's say, third party payments, the psychiatrists want to get them. Social workers, the same thing happened. Psychoanalysts, also other groups want to keep them out. So I'm wondering that it's not just a medicalization of psychoanalysis, it's also an economic subtext of that. I want the money. And I don't want anybody else to have it.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things I thought of afterwards was that if we were doing it over, I think I would have the expression follow the money over several chapters. There's I'll give you just one example, but I think this is dramatically underestimated, and many of the people that I've spoken with don't know this history, but Karen and I developed this at some length. Psychoanalysis played a pivotal role in the move of psychiatry out of the institutions where they were asylum doctors and opening up of private practices. People were largely psychiatrists. The great majority of them up to the 1920s were working in asylums. They were doing custodial care. Largely these were patients who were chronically ill, often old age, senile, often syphilitic degeneration, and they were doing custodial work. And all of a sudden, an import from Europe, intellectually rich, intellectually stimulating, in which they can make a living in a private practice, treating patients that can afford to come privately, and who are well enough to actually discuss interesting things. So they have a choice. Well, do I want to stay in the asylum world? Psychoanalysis played a pivotal role in this complete economic shift in the profession of psychiatry. That's one example of the kind of thing we examine with some care.
I think we'll take one more question.
So, Jamie Katz. So if, just going with the metaphor of the Titanic, psychoanalysis is a sinking ship and the bickering, whether or not it happened tonight, I'm not totally clear, is us rearranging the furniture on the deck. So if we stop rearranging the furniture on the deck and all get along and recognize that we have more in common than we disagree, what do we get out of doing that? Like, does that all of a sudden make psychoanalysis no longer be a sinking ship? Will all of a sudden everyone be in analysis, everyone will be happy, or... So why should we stop fighting? Maybe it's fun to fight.
You're certainly asking the right guy about liking to fight. There's no question in my mind that a certain amount of the fighting is really healthy and enlivening. You know, the fact that we have the different tracks at NYU, actually, that's not just so that we can offer a multiple number of theories. It's also because having those tracks sharpens thinking, and that kind of fighting sharpens people's arguments. So I think actually that part is a good thing. You know, if you want to use the model of dissociation and conflict, it's not the conflict that I have a problem with. It's where we become so dissociated that we don't read each other's journals, we don't know what we're thinking about each other, we don't benefit from learning from each other. That's the problem. Arguments between us can be very, very healthy. But I want to, and this may be a good point to kind of reach at the end, I don't see it as a sinking ship. I don't accept that assumption. I think it's in some economic trouble. I think it's changing. It's evolving. I think it's going to sink only in the sense that what it looked like before, that's going to be gone. It's going to look different. It's going to transform. It's going to evolve. That's not the same as thinking. People need to be listened to. There is nobody else teaching therapists how to listen to patients in depth. Nobody else teaches that. They teach you how to intervene. They teach you to use techniques. They teach you what to say. They don't teach you how to sit and listen to somebody over a long period of time through a lot of deep emotion. Nobody else teaches that. That's not going away. That's not sinking.
One thing we haven't talked about here, and that is, you know, what happens if we stop fighting? Well, maybe we can engage the wider world a little bit more. We're very insular, we're very defensive. Cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, has positioned itself against psychoanalysis. It prides itself on being everything that psychoanalysis isn't. But in fact, there are even some commonalities in there, too. And I think it's really important to, you know, at least take a little bit of a break from the infighting and look outward and see what we have in common with other therapies, how we can maybe even consider psychotherapy integration, what's the language, what, you know, what are the concepts that we have in common, but we have different language for, especially when it comes to training new graduate students in psychology. You know, how do we attract them to psychoanalysis? We need to open up to them and kind of and reach out to them in a way that is relevant to their world.
Can I just say one thing? I think
one
very quick thing.
I
think it's wonderful for us. You here, Lou and Patty. And I'm wondering if it would be possible, you know, like in social relationships where one person has the other one over for dinner, the other person sometimes reciprocates. So maybe if it's possible in your facility to figure out some way of including this group somewhere there, I think it would be great to know.
Robert Stallaro about his book, World Affectivity Trauma. I don't know what I'm going to do with the post-Cartesian Heideggerian thinking, but I'll do what I can. So to the listening audience, thanks again. This is your